It's pretty simple. Instead of cutting taxes for the middle class, though, Washington chose to cut taxes for millionaires and corporations and pay for it by cutting Medicare and kicking people off their health insurance. This isn't a middle class tax cut, not even close. 83% of the benefits go to the richest 1% of people in this country.
It's Friday, December 22nd, 2017. Welcome to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. This is Kev Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Each week, I talk to our Capitol muckraker in chief, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. We're flying a little at the seat of our pants today, folks. It's holiday season, and it's been a crazy week, but you know what? There's only so much time in the day. So this week we found out things like, God made Republicans to cut taxes. And that's according to Representative Tom Cole of Oklahoma. It was on following the passage of the GOP tax disaster. The final version of the tax bill is in. And as you heard there in the intro, 83% of the tax benefit goes to the top 1%. Pat Toomey says he's wanted to pass a tax bill like this for 20 years. Piss off to me. And Turning Point USA, you'll remember those as the ones who are now basically applying Koch brother logic to student governments at universities. They are a right-wing, college-oriented group. Turns out that they're now being accused of racial bias and illegal campaign activity. That's according to an awesome piece in The New Yorker this week by Jane Mayer. First J20 protester is found not guilty. We're not out of the woods, though, folks. This is going to be a long, drawn-out process that is going to actually set a precedent for years going forward. At least 18 Senate Democrats fold in their defense of DACA to make sure that the government doesn't shut down. So much for the spine. And in space news this week, before we get to the space news this week, we got to say this. I can't believe I almost forgot to say this right up top here. We're going to have an abbreviated second segment today, folks, because we're going to be doing a joint podcast with the folks over at Inside 254, and we're going to focus on some of the sexual harassment stuff. We'll talk a little about it in our second segment today, but our second segment today will be kind of a little bit of a setup for that podcast. It's something that an idea that Sean came up with, we reached out to Amanda and Colleen over at Inside 254, and they thought this was a cool idea too as well. So we're later on today, after we record this show, we're going to record a second session with just them, and we'll release that as a second podcast. But more on that in our second segment today. In today's last call, the lobbying for galactic capitalism kicks in full time, folks, just like I said it would. You know, guess what? We have an old congressman from Pennsylvania, Robert Smith Walker. He represented the Pennsylvania 16th District from 77 to 97. And he basically says it's time to get off the government teat and turn things over to the market when it comes to space. Good old lobbying. And if you need any last-minute Xmas gifts, we have got some gifts for you from a son of a Coke. We have Free Will Beers, Holiday Schedule, the release of Safe Word, Ralphius and Ella gift bags. Oh, man. Free Will also got installed 7 new tanks. Looks like they're going to be expanding their production. Pizza Boy has got Coconut Sunny Side Up and Cocoa Nib Sunny Side Up. And D's Nugs on tap. Sean loves more about that. Want to remind everybody to tune in to the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV this and every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern. Blah, 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 7 p.m. Eastern. You can stream the show live at freespeech.org. You can also tune in the Dish Network, DirecTV, or through the Free Speech TV app on Roku. And we like to send out a huge thank you to our newest member, Christopher. Christopher, thank you for becoming a member of Raging Chicken. You came in at the $5 a month level. That's phenomenal. Great way to kind of start closing out the year. We've got, like, you know, just over a week left in 2017. We'd love to see some more members coming on board. If you like what you hear, both on this podcast, you like what you read in the pages of Raging Chicken Press, you want to support Pull No Punches Progressive Media, to become a member of Raging Chicken for as little as $5 a month. Just go to the RagingChickenPress.org and look for the support and membership tab, or you just go to patreon.com/RCPress. Click Become a Member, you're on your way. If you're not ready to become a member, no problem. Just go to RagingChickenPress.org and look for the support and membership tab and click on Donate. You can make a one-time donation. I want to remind everybody, we have the end-of-the-year special this year, right now, this week, I should say, for a little over a week left for our closeout of 2017. If you join at the $10 a month level, we will send you your choice of one of the following. Chris Robet's book, Breaking the Spell, A History of Anarchist Filmmakers, Videotape Guerrillas, and Digital Ninjas. If you want to know more about that book, you can check out my Out to Coop Extra interview with Chris a while back. It's a fantastic book. And Chris was up at visiting Kutztown University. I had a chance to meet with him, talk with him, and just kind of see some of the videos he talks about. Fantastic book. Or, if you don't want Chris's book, you can get an official Raging Chicken Press Stay Woke t-shirt that's got our circle logo on the front and a big Stay Woke on the back. It's a black shirt. You can check that out. We're going to put some links down here in the show notes. Or, now this is the a recent addition for this special final week. And since we're having a kind of big crossover Friday today, we're working inside 254. If you remember, we've got some friends over who do this gaming podcast called Old Man and Skinny Guy. And they turned us on to this really cool card game that's called Winterhorn. It's a live-action game. I'm just going to read from the card here. It's a live-action game about how governments degrade and destroy activist groups. By playing law enforcement and intelligence operatives working diligently to demoralize and derail, you'll learn about the techniques used in the real world in pursuit of those goals. To play this game, you will need to complete the rules, blah, 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 blah. Right? So Winterhorn, it's a really cool game. I haven't played it yet. I just got mine in the mail. And no, I'm not promoting them for pay. I bought this myself. Chris over at Old Man from Old Man Skinny Guy basically alerted to us this. It sounded like really cool, so I ordered one, and it looks fantastic. So if you prefer, we'll send you that. So $10 a month, $10 a month member, become a member of Raging Chicken Press. You can get Chris Robet's book, Breaking the Spell, or you can get a Raging Chicken Press Stay Woke t-shirt, or you can get the Winterhorn card strategy game from Bully Pulpit Games. Very cool. Become a member today. Become a member, help us close out this year, and support Fight Back Media. So, man, Sean, it is the time of the season. We should be all happy and, you know, glory, filled with happiness and all this kind of stuff. But, man, we were greeted with a huge tax cut this week.
Yeah, I think it isn't today Festivus?
Is today Festivus?
I don't know. Is it Festivus?
I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. You bring that up and you say, isn't today Festivus, but you don't know yourself?
I thought like Festivus is like a few days. Oh, no, tomorrow's Festivus.
Tomorrow is Festivus. So tomorrow's this is Festivus Eve,
so this is like
Eve,
a pre-Festivus special where we get to air out our grievances.
Where's the
giant poll?
Yeah.
So actually, it was really funny. The people from Tuesdays with Toomey had a Festivus special this past week outside of Senator Toomey's office where they're airing out their grievances.
Nice.
And, you know, some of the responses are about the tax bill that was coming up this week. So I guess there's a lot of grievances to be had.
Well, that dude, man, I mean, Toomey in the Philly.com had a great piece on this and basically highlighting, you know, and again, highlighting Toomey's central role in ushering this this tax bill through. Like, his paw prints are everywhere, or should I say claw prints are everywhere, all over this tax bill, and all the more reason that we should be, like, you know, focused like a laser beam on booting this guy out of office.
Yeah, well, I mean, we got 6 years to think about that.
Well, no, exactly. I mean, we got 6 years, but still, right? I mean, here you go. I mean, you know, this is one of these kind of moments. I mean, not to go too quickly into the rant against the PA Democratic Party, but since it is Festivus, almost Festivus, I might as well at least say that. you know, we've said multiple times on this podcast, you know, look, so much of what we're seeing right now is like, you know, elections have consequences, right? So elections are not abstract. Elections are not simply just ideological. They're also very practical, and they have consequences. So when we see what's happening in Washington right now, we see this tax bill going through that is going to basically – is going to be one of the largest redistributions of wealth upward to the top 1% in the history of this country. That is a direct consequence of Donald Trump being president, right, and taking that over. So the one stopgap that we had was a veto power in the White House, and this is all the way through. So not only does that, but also
– Well, we also had a chance to win the Senate, and, you know –
Well, this is what I'm going to say, but this is like also
to run a really bad candidate in Katie McGinty.
But my point being is also, on the one hand, elections have consequences. On the other hand, right, like failed political operations also have consequences. So when you start kind of like putting forward candidates, right, that are nothing more but mouthpieces for the kind of corporate elite, right, this is what you get. You get Pat Toomey instead of a decent senatorial candidate. You get Pat Toomey back in there to help usher through the tax bill. Right. So, I mean, this is like, you know, I think that's where we got to get our head straight this kind of come year in 2018, man, is that I think we got to get our head straight and say, like, we've got to kind of boot these people off and boot out of office, starting with 2018. But then we have to have our eyes on 2020 and we have to have our eyes on 2022.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be a long 4 years. That's for sure. And if anything this past year showed you, we got the first year down. Three more to go.
First year, and it's not even down yet, man. That's the crazy thing. You know, did you watch any of the tax debates?
I did not. Well, I was working. I was out that day. I was probably off. I think I might have fell asleep around like 6 o'clock in the evening. Or no, I was at Hershey. Yeah, 6 o'clock. I fell asleep at six, or I was like at Hershey Park. One of those things. I just zoned out. It was just something that was going to happen. And then you just have, like right now, you have Doug Jones. Sorry. You have Doug Jones saying that he's going to be voting with the Republicans most of the time when he gets into office. So the stuff that they did, like, you know, would he vote for tax reform? Probably.
Yep. Yep. Oh, my God. Well, I'll tell you. I just look at what Tom Cole said of Oklahoma, right? You know,
God
made Republicans to cut taxes.
Prosperity gospel. Get some Crefo Dalla in there and some other people and, you know, Joel Osteen, other charlatans. And like, yeah, no, God wants the rich. Because when I think about like Jesus, you know, I might not be a believer, but I went to 13 years of Catholic school. When I think of Jesus, you know, I think of, you know, like the parable of Jesus, you know, the five loaves of bread and two fish, yeah, or whatever, two loaves of bread and five fish, and spreading that wealth out through, right, people, you know, distributing wealth redistribution. I think it's socialist Jesus.
Yeah, totally.
Like, I don't think of like Jesus. I don't think Jesus said, fuck you, I got mine and you won't get any.
Yeah, watch this. Not only this, it's like, it's more like this. It's not even just I got mine. It's kind of like this. This is like, you know, their version of Jesus. Their version of Jesus is this.
Blonde hair, blue-eyed.
Hey, look what I can
white
do.
White Anglo-Saxon Jesus.
I can take this water and turn it into wine, and I'm going to make all these bottles of wine, and then I'm going to take this loaf of bread and make all these loaves of bread, right? And I know you're starving, but if you want this, you got to pay up. If not, tough luck on you, right? That's their Jesus. Their Jesus is the Jesus that was like, yes, I can miraculously create things, really, because what happens, like, if you look at the actual story, right, in that scenario, those loaves of bread didn't come from magic. Those loaves of bread became from the freaking workers in the factory who are producing them, right? Except now you're going to take it all over from them and basically force them to buy it back from you, even if they can't afford it. That's the disgusting part about all this.
Yeah. And you know what? You know, it was like I saw an article pop up on my feed and I thought it was like a really good thing. I think like Splinter, one of the Gawker offshoots, Splinter News, had a article saying, I was thinking a lot about the guillotine today, and I couldn't think why. And that's exactly, like, what this is. Like, I mean, you look at, like, the French Revolution, why it happened and everything. You know, most of the wealth got concentrated up to, like, the top, like, 10% of the French society at the time. You had massive deregulation of, like, the grain industry, so people couldn't afford to eat. People couldn't, you know, massive – who would have thought 200 years ago that, you know, deregulating your food markets would have, you know, led to massive famines and stuff like that. But it happened 200 years ago, and it's just like, you know, this tax bill is nothing but a handout for the 1% and the 0.1%. Like, it's like these people I know who are like, oh, I'm a business owner. They're making maybe a couple $100,000 a year if they're lucky, right? Yeah. Like, you're not going to be like helped by this tax bill. You're just a useful idiot in this process.
Well, here's
like
thing.
The people who are going to be helped by this tax bill are the 0.1%, the 0.01%, and the 0.001% who own like a majority, who own like 99% of the wealth within like the top 1%. Like, it's not just like the top 1%. No, it's the top 0.1, 0.01, 0.001% who right. own most of the wealth in the right. country.
Right. And here's, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this past week. I've been thinking a lot about the middle class, and I've been thinking a lot about some of the specifics in this tax bill. And what I mean about the middle class is because, you know, if you read any kind of history of the middle class is really kind of a creation of policy. Right. It's a creation of gifts. Like if you go back to kind of Marxist traditions, right, you're talking about a petty bourgeois, right, the kind of professional class of sorts who are technically not like, you know, owners of the means of production. Right. They're not the kind of the capitalists at the top 1%, but they're kind of paid off. Right. They're paid off so that they can live nicely. And I think that the middle class was also that kind of creation, right? The idea that, you know, when like Rick Smith, for example, always talks about how unions were basically created the middle class in this country. He doesn't just say that kind of like as, you know, a talking point. It's really true. If you look at the kind of the Gilded Age in this country, when you had the last time that we had this kind of concentration of wealth, the only way that, you know, you had the kind of like the house and the picket fence and the, you know, the 2.4 kids and the dog and all that kind of stuff, that particular version of what it meant to kind of live a decent life was precisely because the unions, they organized, they shut down the means of production, they took over the means of production, they forced contracts in order to kind of get paid a decent wage, right? To live a particular style of life. It didn't change their relationship relationship to capital. Right. I mean, it wasn't like they didn't kind of now completely control the companies. Right. But they had more bargaining power. Right. We had it enshrined in law that then workers had the right to bargain. And that kind of gave people a little bit of a leg up. Now, all that stuff has been eroded. Right. All that has been eroded. And now slowly you start to see the kind of disappearance of, quote unquote, the middle class. Right. But, you know, I look at this tax bill and there's, you know, it's really disgusting about how they think about most of us, Sean. I think because what they have done in this tax bill is they've given some crumbs, like for the first few years of the tax bill. And so my guess is that what we're going to see in early 2018 leading up to the election is that people are going to see, not everybody, certainly people at the bottom, no, right? But people in that kind of quote unquote middle class are going to see maybe some minor tax breaks. So maybe small increases in their paycheck, right? Just enough to keep people from kind of an all out full scale revolt, right? We'll have just enough to keep them bought into the system, right? Until the next election cycle comes around. And then everything really just goes to hell. And we're going to have to get it through our heads that, you know, it's not just about the extra $2 in my paycheck, which for all practical purposes doesn't even keep up with inflation. For all practical purposes, it doesn't even get like even a half step forward in kind of recouping the losses over the past three decades, right, that the working class and the middle class have experienced in this country. It does nothing to address those things. It's just a little tiny nibble of the crumb that are dropping from the pockets of the rich. And sometime we're going to have to ask the question, do we actually believe that a plutocracy is a better system? Because that's where we're going. I mean, you know, Nancy Pelosi said that this week. This is kind of a vote for plutocracy. You know, but you know what? She hasn't done a whole lot in terms of pushing back super, super hard to begin with. But we have to start saying, like, no, look, we need to take it away from the middle class. We need, I mean, from that top 1%, from that capitalist class. It needs to be taken back. And I don't think there's any way around it. I mean, that's what we're talking about. They're taking everything away. The crumbs aren't enough. We need a different kind of society.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, I was thinking about this type of stuff. This goes back to, I mean, this is exactly what Sanders campaigned on. This is exactly what Occupy focused on, was the creation of oligarchic society where you know, this is them cementing their fortress pretty much. This creates two separate societies, one for the uber rich and the wealthy, and the other one for everyone else. You know, it's kind of scary. You know, working with Rick, you know, Rick always said we're going back to the Lochner era.
Yep.
It's scary. It's scary knowing that we're going back to like the 1800s. We're not going back to. You know, we're not going back to the 80s. We're going back to the 1880s, is yep. what he would usually say. And it's like we're taking a step back like 200 years in society with this. Stuff that's going to be coming down the line, going after workers' rights, workers' protections, and stuff like that. You know, this is going to be a drastically different looking country in the next couple of years than it is right now. And it's going to be scary once that happens.
No, exactly. Exactly. And I don't have to say.
This is your dystopic future.
It is. It
staring
is.
Staring you right in the face.
But it's like, slow burn. You know, I mean, the thing about about dystopic science fiction, right, is the thing is that you're always seeing it after the fact, right? So there's a gap between like where we are now and that future, right? So that you can see it more clearly, right? And that's kind of always the idea. I've actually kind of worked on, over the years, I just kind of, again, who knows if I'll ever actually write this thing, but it's this idea that's been stuck in the back of my head. And I jot down kind of pieces of this story, of the science fiction story. And I'm really fascinated about how you get people to see things as they're happening, as opposed to, you know, hindsight is 20/20, because that's really, you know, these small incremental changes, they seem small at the time, that people can recover from or adapt to, you know, or tighten their belts in the short term. But it's the additive value of all of those moves that have been taking place for the last 30, 40 years by, you know, the billionaire funded Koch brother funded agenda here, that eventually we're going to get to the point where, you know, and frankly, we might be there already. Where there is no return. So, I mean, that's the kind of stuff is like, you know, the dystopic future, you can look back and say, oh my God, how different this is. But what about when it's actually happening? Like, what about
And it's also, you know, we're here also because of Democrats being afraid of running on raising taxes.
That's right.
Decades. Oh man, they said I'm raising taxes. How do I respond? Like, I can't respond to that because they're just going to, you know, We can't come up with a message for that. You know, that's it. That's the Trump card.
When, right.
Like, really, they just never want to put the time and effort in to, like, okay, you don't want to pay taxes? Well, you don't get this. You don't get that. You don't get your free – you can't have a free meal and eat it too,
right,
pretty much. Like, you know, this is also years of blundering, and the Democrats not willing to come up with the right messaging to paying for you know, having a sustainable tax rate.
Right. Well, again, I'm going to push back on this. It's not just messaging. It's policy, right? It's actually commitment. It's actually what their priorities are.
And also your DLC Democrats, like this time last year, or no, October of last year, we were talking, what, Chuck Schumer was all giddy about cutting the capital gains tax.
Yep.
I mean, these are the leaders we have in office, too. You know, it's not going to change until all these people are gone, especially the Chuck Schumers of the world and the Nancy Pelosi's.
Yep, exactly. Exactly.
Because they are protecting the oligarchic society.
Absolutely. Well, I think – did you happen to catch David Dayan on the Majority Report this week?
I have not.
It's worth a listen. For anybody who's listening to this, go back to the Majority Report and listen to the interview with David Dayan. I think it was on Wednesday. And he made this one hopeful point in all of this, right? Which was it was the kind of thing like this is why I love David Dayan's work, right? And I'm so glad that I was introduced to his work through the Majority Report. That he says there's one positive here if you have the mass mobilization from the left to like retake or take over the Democratic Party and to push in this agenda. So basically what he said, so we've heard the numbers, like $1.5 trillion tax cut, right? $1.5 trillion redistribution of taxes, of wealth to the top 1%, right? What he said, see if I can get this right, is like effectively what that does is that creates a pool of money of $1.5 trillion. Okay? And this is what he means by that. So say, for example, you've got Democrats who come back and take over the House, take over the Senate, and kick the freaking orange Cheeto out of office, right? You've got retake those things. What do? You basically campaign on repealing the Trump tax cuts, right? You're going to repeal the Trump's tax cuts, and then you're going to give everybody, pick your thing, free health care, everybody, universal health care, boom, right? Single payer, or free college for everybody, right? Or, right, universal basic income for everybody. And how do you do that? Well, because basically, just by repealing those tax cuts, you now have $1.5 trillion to work with. Or billion dollars, I'm sorry. 1.5, is it trillion, trillion or billion?
Probably trillion with a T. Yeah. Billion's too light, too low.
Yeah, I was like, billions. You have that, now you have that money to work with, right? Because you had given that to these uber wealthy, and now if you're going to repeal it, you've got a chunk of money that is not allocated towards anything at that point. And so then what you do is your policy is based on taking that 1.5, right, and redistributing it to whatever program it is that's going to benefit the most people possible. And frankly, DSA is already moving on this when they're talking about universal healthcare.
Yeah, the DSA, there's been a couple stories this week where the Nation had a really good, like, 3,000-word write-up or profile, like 2,500-word profile on the DSA, you know, charting its history, where the DSA, back when it was started, was the place for the old, new left people to go from the 70s. Yep. Into the 80s. Now the DSA is the new left again, where, you know, you had 30,000 people. You have 30, I think it's their membership's up to 32,000 people. They went from 7,000 to 32,000 within a year, dues-paying members. And they are outlining where the Democrats have to go. The Democrats can't just ignore the DSA.
Right.
The Democrats have to embrace their policies or they'll be left behind.
Well, and I think the DSA was doing a bang up job. And again, it's not just the DSA. DSA, as I think, is doing phenomenal work, especially with their training of people on the ground. It's also organizations like Our Revolution, right, that came out of the Bernie Sanders campaign, right. It's also these kind of, you know, kind of smaller based kind of regional organizations that are creeping up to push the takeover of the Democratic Party chapters in their local areas. What's come out of the indivisible groups. It's the kind of the Women's March folks, the kind of, you know, who've continued to organize in their communities to kind of build policy. It's all this stuff coming together, which is phenomenal. And I think that, you know, the more that these groups, and again, it's been impressive. The one thing that Trump has been able to do, right, he's been able to kind of keep the opposition from eating itself, right? I mean, so far, keeping the left from eating itself at this point, which is a good thing to give us some time to kind of develop a kind of response. I just hope that we can hold enough stuff back, which is going to be important. But so anyways, there's a tax cut. I mean, we're going to see what more implications of this. I mean, Trump has not signed this into law. He's not supposed to sign it until January, in part because they screwed it up. They rushed it through so fast that they've got to figure things out. The IRS doesn't know how it's going to be able to accomplish what, you know, change the codes for things like reporting and withholding and all this kind of stuff in time. But so we'll see what happens in the new year. I'm sure we're going to be talking about this a lot. The other thing I wanted to bring up today is that, you know, something you've been reporting on for a while, Sean, about the Turning Point USA. Remember, I think 2 weeks ago we talked about their conference coming up, right, with their, you know, their leadership conference that's actually happening, that are happening this week.
With Gorka.
Yeah, with Gorka. My name is Sebastian Gorka. The Pajama Boys. The alpha males are back. It's like Sebastian Gorka. Well, so basically, the leadership conference that the Turning Point USA, again, kind of billionaire backed organization that has been funding, you know, basically conservative groups building up chapters and colleges and universities across the country, have been funneling money into like student government elections and things like this. I mean, it's insane to see it to this level. Donald Trump Jr. actually was the keynote speaker into leading off their conference this week. So that's all taking place. And Jane Mayer on The New Yorker has got this great piece out, basically drawing attention to the fact that Turning Point USA has now been accused of racial bias and illegal campaign activity during the 2016 campaign. So now you're basically seeing that this group could potentially be into some serious trouble, you know, in part because of its hubris, in part because, you know, these folks thought that they could just get away with it. They were funneling money to kind of like pushing their members to kind of go on and campaign for Ted Cruz at one point. There's close relationships with the Trump organization, and they're basically saying file, you know, there's potential violations of the tax code. Because unlike something like MoveOn.org, right, which is a 501c4, right, which allows for campaign activities, it has to disclose donors above a particular level. Turning Point USA is a 501c3, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, which basically members or people can donate to them and not have to disclose their identities, and they get a tax write-off for this. They're not, and by, you know, and if you're going to do that, you cannot campaign for any political candidate. You cannot be involved in elections. And so there you have it. You know, and now we're seeing that got close. You know, this kind of close relationship. So check out that piece for Jane Mayer in The New Yorker. It's kind of an important one, especially when you find out that one of their kind of their lead organizers, her name, last name was Clanton. Let me see if I can pull out her for Crystal Clanton, I believe her name was. She was found out. Crystal Clanton. She served until last summer as the group's national field director. And according to some sources inside of Turning Point, this is in Mayer's article, she's basically was the person who ran stuff. There was this guy, something David Kirk or something, Chris Kirk, who actually founded it. But she's the one who ran it. And she's basically now being held to task because there was a tweet that she sent to another Turning Point employee that said this. And again, fair warning, everybody, here's the language. she tweeted to another employee, said, "I hate black people, like fuck them all. I hate blacks. End of story." Right. And this was their national field director. There was one African-American woman who was hired by Turning Point, and her last name was Ficchieri, I believe is how you say it, Gabrielle Ficchieri. She was a Turning Point employee. She was the only one there. She felt incredibly, incredibly uncomfortable working there. And the way when they finally decided to get rid of her, they decided to fire her on Martin Luther King Day, right, as a kind of to add insult to injuries. Perfect example. So check out that piece for The New Yorker because, you know, Sean, this is exactly the kind of thing that you've been pointing to with Turning Point, and you've also kind of drawn attention to the fact that Turning Point has been active in Pennsylvania.
Yep, they've been active on Pennsylvania campuses. I know, just threatening professors at this point, but no, they're active around on Pennsylvania campuses.
Crazy, crazy. This is on the scale of updates. Sean, you brought this right before we went on the air today to record. We've got some updates about the J20 protesters, the J20 case.
Yes, so the first batch of protesters, the first six were found not guilty in the J20 case. You know, if they were convicted, they would have been facing like 6 years in prison. So I guess we got some good news there. A few of the people were from the Philadelphia and the Pennsylvania area who were found not guilty.
Well, there you go. Do you know any status of the other cases about how many?
They're being tried in batches of six.
Yeah, batches of six.
So this is the first one, all not guilty.
There you go. There you go. Let's hope that that trend continues, especially because, have you seen this, Donald Trump has been able to appoint district judges at record paces. At a record pace, he's appointed more district judges than I believe this is correct. Any president before him by this time in his thing. So we're going to lose the courts pretty bad. So the more that the better these cases get through now, before it turns even worse, that'd be a good thing. And lastly, before we go to a break, if you recall, one of the things that was, they wanted to get the tax bill done ahead of the Christmas break and things like this, in part also because there's a budget battle that's going on. We're going to hit the debt ceiling. There's a potential that the government might have to shut down unless this budget is passed. There was a temporary bill that was put in place, stopgap measure that was put into place just to allow it to expire by like yesterday, today or something like this. A whole bunch of, you know, and if that did not get through, if another either budget wasn't passed or another stopgap measure wasn't put in place, the government would shut down right over the holidays and stuff. Democrats were holding out in part because they wanted language in there that was going to kind of reinstill DACA as part of it. But that's kind of not where we are, huh, Sean?
Correct. 16 senators voted for the bill, 16 Democrats, I mean, and basically, they delayed the DACA vote until next month. And also, CHIP expires at the end of the year, and Republicans aren't going to be moving on that. So I guess that's a couple of things to look forward to for the holidays.
Yeah, it's not a good one. But I don't know, man. This tax bill has just got me really depressed this week. I was saying to my wife, I was like, you know what? I just – I just don't know what to do at this point. I mean, it's just the only thing you can do is keep on fighting back. But it's like you're watching this and it's, you know, on the one hand, the train is actively running people over. And I don't think enough people yet see it. And it's disheartening at times. And especially when I look at, you know, now the Republicans have actively come out and basically said that they're going to go after entitlements, quote unquote entitlements. They're going to go after Social Security. They're going to go after Medicaid. They're going to go after Medicare. That's going to be next on the agenda. And you've got Paul Ryan out there basically saying things like, the problem is that, you know, women aren't having enough kids, right? The problem is that he's like, I did my part. We had three kids. But, you know, we need to have more children. We need to have more children. That's the problem. As if the problem is that we don't have enough kids, which doesn't – the math is not even accurate in terms of, like, the numbers of new workers that are coming in. The math's not even accurate. But he says that the problem is that there's kids. So these people are unbelievable. So anyways, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're just going to give you a little bit of a preview of about our special – a kind of joint podcast with Inside 254 today. Then we'll do a last call for you. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We will be back right after this break.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1910. That was the day a catastrophic fire broke out in the Chicago Union Stockyards. It claimed the lives of 21 firefighters and was considered the worst in the line of duty tragedy with fatalities in fire service until September 11, 2001. The fire broke out in warehouse number 7 of the Morris Beef Company. By the time the fire was extinguished, 26 hours later, 50 engine companies and 7 hook and ladder companies had been called to the scene. They arrived by horse-drawn steam engine and trucks. Fire hydrants nearby had been shut off previously over concerns of freezing. This, coupled with animal fat and grease throughout the warehouse, contributed to the quick spread of the fire. Railway cars and other buildings also surrounded the warehouse. This made it more difficult for firefighters to access it. Soon after they arrived, the building exploded and a wall collapsed on the firefighters. Their comrades frantically rushed to dig them out of the scorching hot rubble with their bare hands. But the explosion had caused a second fire in a nearby warehouse. It took another day before the debris had cooled enough to resume recovery efforts. Various causes for the fire have been considered, from faulty electrical outlets to the bursting of ammonia pipes. 19 widows and 35 orphaned children were left behind just before Christmas. Directly behind the Union Stockyard gate, at the intersection of Peoria and Exchange Streets, is a memorial statue commemorating the tragic loss of firefighters' lives. At the time it was dedicated in 2004, the names of 530 firefighters were carved along its base.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken's Out to Coop podcast. So, like I said, we're going to have an abbreviated second segment today. I just want to give you a little bit of a preview about this. So, Sean, why don't you kind of introduce this a little bit? Because and we've been talking about the issues of sexual harassment, the issues of sexual misconduct, of hostile work environment in the Capitol. And then you came up with an idea to kind of do a special podcast, and we were able to put it together.
Yeah. So, for the past couple of weeks, we've been talking a lot back and forth, especially off the podcast, and not on the official chat lines. But pretty much, we knew of a couple of sexual harassment stories coming out. There's a bunch that are still yet to be released. There's at least 5 or 6, maybe 7 or 8 legislators going to be implicated in this scandal. The Philadelphia Daily News, The Inquirer, published their first 2 stories on this. Pennsylvania State Senator Dan Leach was accused of sexual harassment in the workplace by telling crude and rude jokes repeatedly when staffers complained to him not to do that, while they were campaigning. This is on the campaign trail for his state senate seats. And also him inappropriately touching female staffers either on the thigh or on the back in a way where they did not feel comfortable. You know, the allegations against Dan Leach were something, as I was reading the story, I thought he could have survived, not have to resign in shame over that. But his social media public statement pretty much put that to rest, right? The statement he released after the news story was released. Dan Leach, he started off by saying, in June, people affiliated with one of my political opponents started a whisper campaign against me. After some prodding, the media picked it up. Media outlets, including Inquirer, filed right no requests for complaints filed against me, though none exist. Inquirer reporters called my Senate staff. Reporters later told me that my Senate staff said I was a great boss and there were no problems. And then Leach goes on to attack the journalist, a female who wrote the story, Angela Columbus. And then he goes out to pretty much call out in a public statement one of his accusers for telling rude and crude jokes in the workplace after she said not to. This staffer is is one of the best Democratic fundraisers in the state. And he pretty much called her out by name in his public Facebook post. And then Leach didn't stop there. One of Leach's accusers, our friend Colleen, she went to write in that thread basically saying, listen, this is not a conspiracy against you. This actually happened. This wasn't not ginned up by your campaign opponents. But here's why we came out and why we waited so long, because we were afraid of saying something. And we finally stood up and said, you know, this. And Leach goes on to her, calling her a horrific monster who fabricates insane attacks and laughable lies against someone who has never been anything but nice to you. To hell with what you do to my family, my kids, progressive movement, etc. I hope whatever it is that makes you such an unhappy person gets resolved. In a world where making progress is so freaking hard, you are just a human wrecking ball of hate. And then Leach made that comment that night. And then the next day, a fellow supporter posted a picture of Dalen Leach, this older woman standing with Dalen Leach, said, I stand with Dalen, and his very respectful hand on my shoulder, where Dalen goes on to respond, I'm very sorry if I traumatized you. And sort of make a joke after that. And she responded, after years of therapy, I'm almost over it.
It was disgusting. That interchange and Dalen's comment back to Colleen were disgusting.
Yes. This is why he should resign. I thought the allegations, he might have been able to skate it out if he just released a public statement saying, I am sorry about the allegations that were made. I'll try to correct myself in the office, you know, try to take a better stance with that. And I will just come up with a stock statement, you know, addressing the inappropriate touching. He decided not to do that. He did not apologize in any of his statements. And then he decided to go on and make a mockery about the issue going on and also attack He attacked pretty much every single woman involved in this,
right?
The journalist and the two female staffers, former campaign interns or staffers who decided to go to the media on this. So he pretty much attacked every woman and not apologize about the situation at all.
I think that ultimately he would probably have had to resign anyways, like as this kind of played itself out, just in terms of like political isolation. But like, unlike what you saw Al Franken do, right? I mean, Al Franken came forward and does this. And again, there was clear evidence of kind of things that took place. There was, you know, he basically disputed some of the claims that were being made.
But
the problem is that with Franken is that Franken comes out of that and he's got some kind of integrity left, that he's got some reckoning that he has to do. Leach basically burnt any possibility of him being able to do anything in the future by doing this. I mean, basically exposed exactly what these women have been saying about his manner.
Yeah. And, you know, talking to staffers – or not talking to staffers, but talking to female lobbyists in the Capitol the past few weeks, the stuff that I could feel comfortable reporting on is that none of these women I talked to have ever felt comfortable being alone with Dalen at a fundraiser on an elevator in a hallway with him. He is one of the legislators that, you know, Leanne Kruger, Brannicki, and others were talking about a secret list of legislators you don't want to be alone with on an elevator in a hallway. He was one of the legislators that I believe that they were referring to from my own personal talking to people within the Capitol. You know, I've just spent a couple of weeks, the rumors are swirling and everything, and you spend the time talking to people about the rumors. And he was definitely one of the people that no woman feels comfortable being around by themselves. And this wasn't just before these stories were starting to break, right, or the rumors were starting to swirl. This is going back years. I would not be surprised if anything else comes out of this, with especially with Senator Leach. He pretty much burned any, and he pretty much destroyed any credibility he had left,
right,
by attacking the victims and making a mockery out of his sexual harassment allegations, where he should have just shut up and be quiet for a few days.
I agree. And I think that, this is one of the things that, one of the reasons why, you know, when Sean was first floating the idea to me about, you know, seeing if we can do a joint podcast with Amanda and Colleen from Inside 254. And I should be clear, this is Colleen Clemens, right? Because there's two Colleens here. There's Colleen, who's involved with the Dale and Leach stuff. Colleen Clemens is Inside 254 podcast, who I work with at Kutztown. I work with Amanda at Kutztown too as well. But the idea here is twofold. Like, one, you know, you have the individual allegations against particular legislators that this is kind of moving forward. But more importantly, in some ways, it has to do with what you were just referring to, is that we talk about this hostile work environment. We talk about this kind of, say, rape culture. We talk about what Colleen Clements had talked about as toxic masculinity. This is precisely that issue. So, on the one hand, the response here is twofold. One, obviously, you have to hold these individual legislators accountable. And the second and even more important part, right, is to basically, as part of that accountability, we have to fundamentally alter this toxic culture within Capitol. Because you'd imagine the women who had worked as part of the Capitol to kind of, because they cared about politics, they wanted to be involved with this stuff, had to kind of put up with that kind of behavior on a regular basis. So there were informal networks of sharing, saying, hey, listen, you don't want to be in an elevator with that legislator. You don't want to talk to them. Do not be alone with this person. And that's how most of these women have survived, right, in those environments. And that has got to end.
Yeah. And these lists, these secret lists, or like these informal networks, they span the offices of both caucuses or both parties. You know, women, female staffers in both parties know who to be with and who not to be with, especially with, you know, information gets around. Another legislator got accused of sexual harassment that resulted in a $250,000 payout in 2015 is State Representative Thomas Caltagirone, who is from the Reading, Pennsylvania area, Berks County legislator. In that story, there's also a long expose. Don't have the notes in it right in front of me, but it also recounts a couple stories of harassment dealing with Caltagirone going back in the 90s and 2000s. One of the payouts, his main payout was back in 2015 that resulted in a $250,000 payout from the House Democratic Caucus. Since 2007, the House Democrats have had over $600,000 in payouts. Two of them dealt with sexual harassment cases. The other two dealt with workplace harassment cases. And those had to be approved by the House Democratic leader, Frank Dermody.
There you go. Well, you know, I think there's
got to be. So we've also had some off the record conversations over the past couple weeks about this,
yep,
story in particular. And it just seems like from observing it from behind the scenes, the House Democrats are doing everything wrong.
Yep.
And how to address this.
Yep. I think. Yeah.
I said to you, when we were
on the phone yesterday, I was like, look, I can tell you they hired consultants and the consultants are telling them X, Y, and Z, which is everything was exactly the wrong thing to do. They're basically got their head stuck so far into the freaking sand and they think that they can weather this storm. Well, the only way you quote unquote weather this storm is you come clean on your practices. You apologize for what you did. You acknowledge that there needs to be a fundamental sea change within the Democratic caucus. You don't sit there and try to like tacitly defend kind of abusers, number one. You don't sit there and you hide behind your kind of, we don't know if there were technically staffers or not, blah, blah, blah. No, if you knew about it and you did nothing, this is a serious problem, especially for a party who pretends to uphold progressive values.
And then also, Dermody released a weak-ass statement regarding Caltagirone, where he bragged about passing House Resolution 612 that added a third hour of ethics training regarding sexual harassment every session one session, you know, goes from 2 hours to 3 hours regarding sexual harassment training, you know, once every 2 years.
Yeah, that's the leader you want right there, man. Problem solved, bro. Problem solved, right? I mean, look at this, Sean. I mean, he's done, right? I mean, look, I don't understand what the big deal is. Like, he added a third hour of sexual harassment training. Problem solved, right? That's insane. That's insane. Now, let's be clear, just so we can't be taken out of context, right? A third hour of sexual harassment training is a good thing, okay? But to then make the huge leap to say that that third hour of sexual harassment training, right, is all you need to do, and that therefore erases all of what you've done and somehow solves this toxic culture is insane, right?
And,
this is why we're having public reckonings right now, because that garbage, that does not work.
So the Calthedrone payout happened before he was reelected for his 21st term. He was also a Senate or House chairman sitting on the Senate or the House Judiciary Committee as a co-chair, minority chair on the House Judiciary Committee. And then also to make things better, he has no plans on resigning, and he wants to run for a third another for his 22nd term.
Well, I'll tell you, Indivisible Burks, if you're listening, if you folks, Indivisible Burks, man, get your frickin' candidates ready to take this guy down. Primary the hell out of him. And if any of you out there, I mean, who knew about this behavior, right, and still supported this guy, gave money to his campaign, right, and actually contributed to the kind of like brushing this stuff under the rug, man, it's time to kind of do some serious self-reflection as we move forward, right? Because, I mean, this is the whole system has got to come down.
And then lastly, Keystone Progress, along with Lancaster Stands Up, Reclaim Philadelphia, 215 People's Alliance, and the Neighborhood Network Group organization, they have called on the Pennsylvania Democratic Party and Marcel Groen to come up with a comprehensive sexual harassment policy by January 5th. They're demanding that they do that. This stems from an incident that happened at a nightclub during the Philadelphia convention, the Democratic convention, when a Pennsylvania delegate sexually harassed and groped a member of the Philadelphia delegation, the Pennsylvania delegation, at a bar, and pretty much has been inactive on this. After this happened, the Democratic Party and Marcel Groen, who was from Montgomery County, where Dalen Leach is from, you know, who was the head of the Montgomery County Democratic Party, which is where Dalen Leach's main part of his district is in, they have pretty much brushed this underneath the rug. They have failed in their keeping their promises on coming up with a sexual harassment policy. And this has renewed the calls for that. The Pennsylvania Democratic Party, the state party, has been extremely quiet on this issue as well. Not just the House leaders or the legislative leaders, but also our party has been extremely quiet, not mentioning a single word about these two incidents that have happened. And one thing I could promise you, there will be more.
So more, stay tuned, right? I mean, it's I tell you, folks, it's
there,
weird.
There is going to be more. Trust me, we are not done. We are not out of the woods yet. You know, I'm pretty much like, there's going to be 7 or 8 legislators involved in this.
You know, it's been interesting. I have to say, it's been an interesting process over the past several weeks when, in part because of the networks that Sean has built up in the Capitol, and the people who will talk to him, but will not go on the record about anything, will just kind of be part of that. You start to see these stories coming together well before they hit the pages. I mean, literally, if you followed Sean's Twitter account or my Twitter account or saw something, you would have noticed that we thought that there were stories that were going to drop about a week before they actually did. Kind of like sitting there waiting, because you know this stuff is coming, and you wonder if there's going to be, you know, if the stories are going to break. And I could only hope that you got editors in newsrooms, right, especially in the major papers in the state, the editors in these newsrooms are not going to kind of damp things down and basically contribute to the silencing of these women who are coming forward. I'm not saying that has happened. I'm just saying that that's always a concern of mine, especially when you've got some of these legislators like Dalen Leach and things who have got active lawyers and look like they're probably, my guess is that in communication, at least, with newsrooms that are breaking certain kinds of stories. And the concern there is always, and I have no evidence to say this is taking place, but as be clear, but the concern there is that legal threats coming from individuals or organizations or things like this could cause editorial boards to basically steer away from any kind of, say, conflict. I think we need journalists and we need newspapers today that are going to be willing to kind of stand with the rest of us, right? Going to stand especially with these women who are coming forward to help kind of end this. I mean, if journalism has ever been about shining a light on things to show the truth, to expose corruption, this is a time that we need that kind of journalist and we need that kind of journalism. So,
yes. And one of the things that we've known about the Leach story going into it was that Leach was going to take the low road no matter what. These were the rumblings I've gotten from many party activists and, you know, just people within the Democratic Party who are activists or committee members who also heard rumblings of the same thing. We all knew pretty much that the weeks leading up to it that Dalen Leach and his surrogates were going to take the low road in all of this.
Yeah.
You know, and I try to explain that to someone. It's like, as horrific as the comments or the jokes may seem, I'm not surprised that that happened.
Sad, man.
I mean, people are shocked by that, but, you know, from the people I was talking to, the stuff that's been happening behind the scenes, I get back to you. You know, I really can't say what just because of issues.
Right.
But people just talking. It just, you know, everyone knew that Dalen Leach was going to be taking the low road in this. And we just didn't know how low he was willing to go. And he showed that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's it is a shame. You know, and I was saying to somebody this past week when I was saying how it's sad to see this. Right. And this person was saying to me, yeah, but did you really not expect it? Are you surprised by it? And I was like, no. You're mistaken what I'm saying. I'm not surprised by it, right? I'm not shocked, right? Like some complain to be. But it's nonetheless sad. I mean, I felt the same way with Al Franken, right? And again, that's not to say that this shouldn't happen, right? But it's like you want these people to be better, right? And you don't want to have, like, women kind of systematically disenfranchised from their work, from oppressed, from feeling like they've got to kind of, like, you don't want this, right? And it's like these people, and this is why some of these conversations around that just drive me insane, is like, look, these people, like Dalen Leach, right, are setting us all back through their actions. And yet they try to flip it around and say that the women who are coming forward, right, are interfering with like progressive agenda. No, they are the ones that are doing this, right? And so, you know, I mean, I see some of the defenders of Dalen Leach in particular that I've seen on his Facebook page and see on social media that really just frankly make me sick when they kind of say that the women are, by coming forward, the women are to blame. And kind of giving Dalen a pass on this stuff.
Or they should have shut up and dealt with his jokes.
Right. I mean, it's just, it's sickening. It really is. Which goes to show you that this is not simply a partisan issue, right? That, you know, there's deep, deep sexism, right, on the left as there is on the right. There's racism on the left as there is on the right. And the only way we get through this is we're going to be honest and we're going to come, you know, and speak frankly about this stuff. And, you know, to be in a constant state of self-reflection too, as well, about how we all do these things better. Nobody is perfect. Nobody is kind of like, you know, some sort of pristine kind of like cleric that has done nothing wrong in their life, right? Or doesn't say something wrong all the time. But the idea is that we're conscious and having conversations about this and listening to each other to make this world a better place. I don't see any way around it, but, you know, it's my happy holiday thing, so. Anyway, so we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with our last call and then prepare, right? So we've got about a half an hour between the time we end this today and then when we start recording with Amanda and Colleen. Basically, we're going to send this off to a happy holidays thing and look forward to the rest of it. So anyways, I'm just babbling at this point, so I'm just going to shut up and go to the break so we can get to our last call. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll be back right after this break.
This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Over the past 6 years, we've brought unapologetic, progressive, activist media to Pennsylvania and beyond. We've helped hold those in power accountable and shine a light on some amazing activist work. We've broken national stories and established a reputation as an aggressive, independent media site. As newsrooms close and traditional journalists lose their jobs, hard-hitting, investigative news suffers. If we care about our democracy, we have to find new, sustainable models of journalism. And frankly, no one's going to do it for us. After the Trump election, we dug in even deeper. Thanks to some longtime members, one-time donations, and a shift in other resources, we brought on more writers and started paying them. Now we're doubling down and want to expand our infrastructure and pay our writers even more. We need to invest in our media if we have a chance to resist the unprecedented assault on democracy, working families, women's rights, and our planet. History will remember the choices we make today. So take a minute to become a member of Raging Chicken Press. For as little as $5 a month, the price of a local craft beer or a cup of coffee, you will be supporting homegrown progressive journalists and media activists. Go to RagingChickenPress.org and click on the Support and Membership tab to become a member. Leave a one-time donation or learn about other ways that you can help. We don't have billionaire backers. Keeping progressive activist media going strong depends on you. Thank you for all your help and support. Keep up the fight.
Hey, everybody. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press, coming back with Out the Coop's Last Call. Today on the last call, we got some space news, we got some beer news, and we've got a special last-minute gift-giving guide, right, for all you fans out there. Let me get to the space news first, because that's the kind of the more serious of anything that we've got here. I almost want to say, you know, this is like, I told you guys so, right? For all the kind of, you know, my focus on the space news stuff and everything, for those of you who might be a first time listener, let me give you like this is like with space news is that my contention has been for a while now that what the developments that we're seeing in space, whether it was the exploration, particularly around kind of a Martian expeditions and kind of new space technology and these companies that are emerging, is that basically we're looking at a kind of a frontier of what I've been calling galactic capitalism that could potentially usher in this kind of like no holds barred kind of quote unquote free market, corporate free market, and really corporate colonization process that is, you know, that brings us to that shows us the worst of the dystopian futures that we've seen in science fiction. Right. And I think that is happening right now as we speak. So like I was mentioning earlier on in the show today is I've been fascinated with that part. It's like, yes, one thing dystopian fiction allows you to look back and say, oh, my God, look what happened. Look at where it's got us. And we can see that 2020 hindsight that something went wrong. But I've been fascinated about what happens in that time when these changes are actually happening on a much more incremental and slow level. Right. So anyways, that's a little bit of the background. So this past week, there's this guy. His name is Robert S. Walker, and he's interesting for a couple of reasons. One, Robert Smith Walkers, or that's the S, he actually represented Pennsylvania's 16th congressional district from 1977 to 1997, right? So he worked in government for a long period of time, and he is now the executive chairman of Wexler & Wexler, and they are a lobbying firm. Right. And one of their things that they lobby on is space policy and space. So he is, you know, he's on the board of directors of a thing called Space Adventurers. And he's also served on the chairman of Space Foundation. And basically this guy, he's important in part because he just wrote this op-ed for this site called Space News. It's circulated wider than this, but he circulated this op-ed for Space News. And Space News is actually a good site to go. It's spacenews.com. And they tend to cover more wonky aspects of the kind of space policy. So not just the kind of the cool stuff, the pictures from NASA and all that kind of stuff, but actually looking at some of the nuts and bolts that's happening behind the scenes. So it's a really kind of cool site. But so this guy, Robert Walker, he wrote this op-ed, and I just want to read some sections of this to you because show you this is exactly the kind of thing I've been talking about, and we're on the cusp of this happening. And Donald Trump, and in part because of Mike Pence, Mike Pence has been this kind of like, you know, lunar lander lunatic for a long time. And I don't mean going to the moon is lunatic, but I mean this guy is like, you know, free market colonist, when it comes to space policy. He's ahead of this, you know, basically bringing the space stuff back in the Trump administration, and Trump is all in for going to the moon and Mars and beyond. So this guy, Robert Walker, here's what he writes. He's like, companies like SpaceX and Blue Origins are creating new generations of launch vehicles capable of doing what only government assets could do in the past. Of course, government is still the largest customer for space launch activity, but even that is changing. Governments across the globe must awaken to a new reality that can now use launch and satellite capabilities built by the private sector. This new reality underpins President Trump's space policy. It is a policy that will put humans back on the moon to stay. Later, we will explore the far reaches of our solar system, first with robots, then with humans. To begin this journey to the stars, the government would shift non-military or intelligence-related low-Earth orbit activities to the private sector. The government will not abandon LEO or low-Earth activities or low-Earth orbit, but it would still be able to buy LEO services from on-orbit commercial assets and access LEO using commercial vehicles. But government would recognize that vehicles and satellites are now mature enough that it doesn't need to control their development. The private sector can take the reins instead. In the very near term, with the right policies, it will be possible to have humans live and work in space in commercially developed stations. The government simply will rent space aboard those stations rather than operate them. Right? This is so important for a whole bunch of reasons. One, you see the language of what government does. It might nurture those little babies, but eventually those babies grow up, right? And you have to let it go. You know, you're basically weaning it off the government teat, as I said at the beginning, right? So that's, and this has been a long-standing free market policy, free market think tank kind of trope that they try to use, right? Now they're grown up and ready to go. You've got to let the government go. But the more important part here is that the corporations would basically then control Earth orbit. Right. And anything on Mars, anything on the moon or anything like this. And the governments are subservient to the corporations in space. Right. So that will have a significant impact in terms of policy going forward. All this is, and this is just one lobbyist that just happened to write an op-ed for Space News that we get to see a window into this stuff. And this will have long-standing effects back upon, like, you know, those of us who are tied to the planet. Right. So number one, if this is successful, that Trump's space policy basically will shift NASA resources all towards getting kind of this commercialization of space and away from NASA spending time looking at climate change, like looking at what's happening on the Earth. Right. It will also change space policy fundamentally, where basically right up until now, right, I think it was the 1950s or 60s is when space policy was first kind of enacted, basically said nobody can own celestial bodies, nobody can own the outer space. It was kind of public, right, and it was the commons. That would fundamentally change too as well by ceding this to corporate dominance. So, you know, I look at this stuff and, like, you know, here it is, man. It's like just in time for Christmas, we get to see that, you know, that grand old North Star that Santa kind of goes by, right, could eventually be kind of only seen, right, through if you pay your fee kind of at the, you know, the corporate check-in ticket booth or whatever. But anyway, so that's my downer of the day. But I just thought it was like just perfect timing. There was a bunch of other stuff I wanted to talk about. There's some cool symbols and things, like not symbols, but images that came out of Hubble. Like you see two galaxies that are kind of collapsing in on each other and stuff, which is really cool to see. But we'll get to that another time. But that just kind of, you put that on people's radar again, because like I said, for the new year, I'll be starting writing about space policy stuff. And because I think we do need to, you know, take the long view on this and actually start unpacking what's actually happening, because it's going to have direct effects back on, you know, those of us, again, like I said, tied to the planet. So, okay, Sean, you can wake up now.
Let me get the crusties out of my eyes.
Yeah, get the crusties out. It's so funny. Like when I'm talking about space policy, right? So I could see Sean, right? So we're recording. So Sean's sitting there, leans back. He starts stretching. You can see he's doing his best to stay awake. He's rocking in his chair. It's hilarious. But you watch. I give it another year, and Sean is going to be a full convert. You'll watch. But crazy. So Sean, you brought this.
Jesus.
What's that? What's that?
So you got a better chance of seeing Jesus walking down Main Street.
Mark this day, everybody. Trust me. And Sean, and you reminded me of this. You got some special ideas for gifts, for those last minute gifts for especially if you're looking for something to
like
buy
Flint
for
Blank shirts.
Yeah, if you're looking for something to buy for your favorite billionaire or something.
If you want to. Try to get me a t-shirt or a button-up shirt with like some really rad designs on it. Head over to Wyatt Ingram Coke and what it means to be bald for him. He is the son of Charles Coke. He has this ridiculous video out of him just talking. You know, my dad told me I can do anything, especially when your dad's a billionaire trying to destroy the country. But Wyatt Ingram Coke owns a shirt company called Wyatt Ingram, and it's friggin' ridiculous.
Oh, he's actually not the son. He's not the son of Charles Coke, right? He's the son of Bill Coke. Yeah. And this thing is hilarious. And so, you really got to see it. So I'm just going to put a link. I'm going to put a link in the thing.
There's just no way of describing it.
There's no way to describe it. So they played this actually on the Majority Report this week and as part of the fun half. And it really is something else. So basically this guy, he makes these shirts, right? They look kind of like Hawaiian shirts, right? The best way to kind of describe them in some ways. But they are like, one has literally bags of money all over it, right? That's like what on the shirt. Another one is a black shirt with like pink handcuff links and stuff. And he's got this video out, and this is what you'll see the link to. He's explained like what it means to be bold. And he talks about how his father always said, do whatever you want, but just do it well. Right. As if like, here's this guy making these like really, borderline hideous. Well, no, hideous shirts. Right. That because he's a billionaire. Right. He can afford to do this. Anyone who is like, trying to start a company up from scratch to try to sell these shirts, there's no way in hell that they would sell. But because he can screw up any way he wants, right, he's still going to be a billionaire. Right? He can just do things that's fun for his friends on the yacht. Right. It's this window into this guy who thinks he's like cool. He thinks he's like, saying something innovative when he's just a little bratty billionaire rich boy, right? Producing these shirts. But so anyways, if you want that special Xmas gift, check it out.
I'd totally wear one. So if you buy me one, I'd wear it.
I'm going to totally do it. Oh, man, crazy. So Sean, anything in the world of beer news?
Yeah, Pizza Boy has four packs and cases of Sunny Side Up with Coconut and a Sunny Side Up with Cocoa Nibs available for sale.
Okay, so what's the difference between with coconut and cocoa nibs?
Cocoa nibs is like chocolate.
Ah.
Like cocoa nibs, the raw chocolate.
I don't know what the hell cocoa nibs are.
And then Sunny Side Coconut is obviously coconut. In case you were wondering.
Boy, are you the head of their PR department? Coconut. One has coconut and the other one has cocoa nibs. Buy some. No, you were mentioned also that on tap there's this one that's called D's Nugs.
Yeah, it's a really nice double IPA. It's like around 8%. Nice light-bodied IPA and had all nugget hops. It's one of the beers I've been drinking. Definitely something to recommend.
Very cool. Very cool. Over here in my neck of the woods over in Free Will, we talked about this last week. They just released Safe Word in cans. And I can report it is as good in cans as it was on tap. I mean, I would still take it fresh out of the tap any day, but it was fantastic. I mean, it was great. The cans are nice and they're, I was so pleased to have Safe Word. And they have the really cool thing right now. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. They released these bombs, really, called Ralphius. There's one. One's Ella. They're the kind of big bottles. They come in at, like, you know, 14% alcohol. I mean, these are really awesome beers that they produce only at Christmas time. They have got special gift bags that are out there, kind of really cool sets. If you're looking for something really special to give somebody who loves beer, they're a bit pricey. I can't remember how much they are, but they're a bit pricey. I was warning you ahead of time, but they're really, really fantastic. So look for that. And just to kind of one last plug, it's like as we're heading into kind of, you know, Christmas and the holiday season, the lead up to Christmas this week is that tonight at Pizza Boy, you're going to get – at Free Will, in addition to obviously awesome beer – you're going to get Urban's wood-fired pizza. They have actually got their food truck out there for tonight. And also a special for tomorrow is that Trey Locally Sourced will be the food truck that will be out there. And on Sunday, they're going to have food from Down to Earth Cafe, which is also a kind of another awesome restaurant, all locally sourced stuff here in Perkasie. They'll have beer. They'll have Down to Earth Cafe food. And they'll be watching the Eagles game. Eagles game. Wait, that was last week.
Yeah, the Eagles play Monday night.
They play Monday night. I was just looking at this. I said, "Well, so I think I got the wrong food stuff." But they got food trucks out there because, like, Sunday. Wait a minute, Sunday's new. I think they're closed on Christmas Eve. So, okay. So I'll post. Just look at the links, and then I'll put the correct stuff in there.
Man, way to go!
I know. I was like, but I looked. I picked it up. I looked at it. Even looked at it ahead of time. But oh well. but they'll have food trucks out there. They are closed for. They are closed for Christmas. They are closed for. Let me see if I can pull it up real fast while we're sitting here, because that just really bothers me.
Wasn't that last week's thing?
Yeah, that was last week's. And so that's what I'm thinking about. What are they doing today? They were posting their schedule. Here it is. Sorry, my bad. Okay, so here's the correct one. So tonight it's Down to Earth Cafe. Okay, this is the right one. Down to Earth Cafe and beer. So Down to Earth Cafe will be there, but they're going to be inside, right? So they're not going to have the food truck. They're actually going to be serving the food inside tonight. On Saturday, they're going to get the Flying Dutchman, or Deutschman, and also awesome beer. And they will be open on Christmas Eve till 6 o'clock for beer and light refreshments. They will be closed on Monday for Christmas, but will open at noon on Tuesday the day after. So get your fix, folks. Yeah, so anything else for the good of the order, Sean?
Nope, that's it.
All right, so we're going to head out of here, folks, and get ready to do our first ever kind of collaborative podcast with the folks at Inside 254. We'll release that later on today, right around the same time we release the podcast. We hope that you all have an amazing holiday weekend. Sean and I haven't really talked about next Friday very much too. So we're going to kind of work out and see what our details look like, see if we're both going to be around and see if we'll have an abbreviated podcast, a full podcast. We'll figure all that stuff out. But we hope you enjoy this podcast. We hope you enjoy your holidays. We hope you enjoy the collaborative podcast with Inside 254. Have a happy and safe holiday season, folks. And we'll talk to you in some fashion next week. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. It's been a good one, folks. Getting close to the end of 2017. See ya!
It's pretty simple. Instead of cutting taxes for the middle class, though, Washington chose to cut taxes for millionaires and corporations and pay for it by cutting Medicare and kicking people off their health insurance. This isn't a middle-class tax cut, not even close. 83%